Thank you very much for coming and welcome to CSIS. I am honored to have two of not just the most esteemed counterterrorism experts, but two people that have been influential in pretty much anything I've ever done. So thanks. Thank you, Peter, sir. And thanks to Bruce for all the work you've done over many, many decades. You know, there's some people that will do work on terrorism, right, on a range of issues, and they've been doing it for a few years, but the collective number of years that you both have been working on this is astounding. I'd also like to thank Danica Newley and Nick and Jake for all of the preparation that they've done for this. They're the real logistical experts and subject matter experts on this issue. So let's get started. Peter, you've just been back from Afghanistan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. Obviously, everybody here is aware that the president and other administration officials have trumpeted that ISIS has suffered a 100% territorial defeat, I think is the quote that I pulled from the president's comment recently. So what's your reaction? And you've especially been to the Middle East. How do you react? What's your sense of ISIS right now and its next steps?
Well, Seth, first of all, thanks for the invitation and thanks to CSIS, and it's great to be here with Bruce as well. We all remember Barack Obama's comment to David Remnick of The New Yorker in January of 2014 when he referred to the JV team, which was a reference to what would become ISIS a few months later. So, I mean, there's a danger in taking a victory lap with these jihadi terrorist groups, because ISIS wasn't really the problem. It was a symptom of some pretty deep problems in the Middle East and Europe, and I use the word Europe, not the West. And in the Middle East, it's, you know, sectarianism, failed governance, failed economies, demographics, and in Europe, it's, you know, the alienation of Muslims in Europe, the rise of ultra-nationalist parties, and the wave of Muslim immigration into Europe. And then add to that social media, and you have a pretty toxic mix that produced ISIS and will produce something not dissimilar to ISIS. It may not be as successful. It may not have territory the size of Portugal and population the size of Switzerland, but it will be something. We don't know what form it will take exactly, but I don't. If we'd had this conversation in 2011, Bin Laden was dead, the Arab Spring had happened, I would have had a much more rosy projection, because I really believed terrorism was going to become a second tier issue, which it may be. By the way, it may well be. If you look at the National Defense Strategy and National Security Strategy, it's treated as a second tier issue. But I think it's going to be a persistent issue for the reasons I've already outlined.
Bruce, your reaction to, and you've written on this recently as well, I think you noted earlier that the White House's own National Counterterrorism Strategy in 2018 states that ISIS maintains 8 official branches and more than 24 networks scattered across Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, Southeast Asia. So you've started to weigh in on this. What's your sense of where we're at?
Right. Well, let me thank you too for this very kind invitation. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and Peter. Well, terrorism isn't about territory. It never has been. I mean, in that sense, ISIS was a tremendous aberration, which is also why it generated so much attention. But it just will merely revert to its DNA, which is to engage in terrorism and in subversion. And this is an organization that, at least when I look at it and what was unique about it, it wasn't only that it had this vast amount of territory, but it seemed to have almost seamlessly achieved what almost no other organizations these days can do, which is to meld together sort of the sensibilities of millennials, young people, people very adept at social media, with the kind of hardened operational knowledge that former Mukhabarat, Secret Service, and Intelligence Service, and Saddam loyalists and people, even if they themselves weren't trained by the East Bloc in the 1980s, are inheritors of that sort of tradecraft and operational skills and communication skills. And that's what made them so effective, which also, I think, suggests that you've got a hard core of survivors that have managed to survive Saddam, survive the U.S. invasion, survive even the takedown of ISIS, and they're not going to fade away.
So one question, Peter, on the next steps, how do you see Baghdadi and ISIS responding in Iraq, Syria, and you can even expand it more broadly to other areas of the globe where they have some networks operating.
They're going to try and carry out acts of terrorism, and they've certainly been doing that in Iraq to some degree. But Baghdad is strikingly, the Iraqis have taken down the green zone, the 20-foot walls, and Baghdad is in a very different place. So they will continue to try and interfere, but I don't think it will have a seismic impact on sort of Iraqi politics, because ISIS was one thing that everybody in Iraq could agree on was a bad idea. Just to emphasize the positive for a second, because we've been emphasizing the negative, the defeat of ISIS is a big deal. And the fact is they have been defeated geographically. And as Bruce sort of indicated, their claim to fame was they had a geographical caliphate to which people could come and live in the perfect Islamic state. And 40,000 people from around the world, including 7,000 people from the West, came because of this claim. Now, no one wants to join the losing team. The foreign fighter flow is zero now, up, down from 1,500 a month. So, that is a big deal. I think we will agree that this is kind of a persistent problem. But let us not forget that under President Obama and also President Trump, we actually carried out probably one of the most successful military operations that the United States is engaged in, because with almost very limited American casualties, supporting local forces on the ground in Syria and Iraq. It was a bit like overthrowing the Taliban in the months after 9/11. It was conducted in a way that was quite successful. And, does that mean a persistent success? Who knows? But it certainly, in the short term, is a very good thing. And Iraq is in a very different place than it was. In 2014, ISIS was 70 kilometers from Baghdad. It's hard to... and now they're basically they're reduced to this much lower level of threat.
Bruce, I wonder if you could give us your perspective on how U.S. counterterrorism has evolved. Picking up on Peter's point, you were there, for example, during the CPA days in Iraq. We had over 100,000 American forces, many conventional in Iraq, same thing in Afghanistan. But the processes the strategy to take down ISIS in Iraq and Syria was a lot more focused on SDF, so local security forces. On the Iraqi side, the counterterrorism service. What's your sense about the evolution of counterterrorism in the U.S. and its upsides? To stay with a positive.
Well, I agree completely with what Peter said, and there's two things. Firstly, every president since the war on terrorism started has declared victory over our adversaries in this and has been sadly disappointed. And I think that does speak to the tremendous progress that we've made serially in the war on terrorism. What I think is the big problem is that we declare victory precipitously and think the problem has gone away and forget the fundamental lesson of terrorism historically, but 9/11 in particular, is that one person or 19 people can change the course of history. And in this sense, what worries me is that we have been tremendously successful, just as you and Peter have described. But as we wrote about 2 months ago in the Wall Street Journal, I think what worries both of us is that because of that success, we're now swinging from the opposite direction. Once invaded countries and attempted to occupy them and have a big footprint. We found the right balance in recent years, both at the end of the second Bush term and the Obama and the beginning of the Trump administration. But what worries me profoundly now, and admittedly I'm more of a pessimist on these things, but studying terrorism is not the most, doesn't give rise to lots of optimism, unfortunately. But what worries me the most is now we're declaring victory, but worse than that, we're outsourcing our counterterrorism to partners of various degree of competency. The French in Mali are great, but AMISOM in Somalia, and we've seen the resurgence once again. Al-Shabaab is a case in point of a group that's lost enormous territory and enormous strength, but still was able to launch a reasonably consequential strike in Nairobi just last month. We've outsourced it to the Turks, allegedly, in Syria. Haftar, of course, in Libya, and I'm sure we're going to get to this, but in Afghanistan, we're planning to outsource it to the Taliban, which I think is disastrous.
So, Peter, you've just been there. Your thoughts on Afghanistan?
There isn't a single Afghan that I spoke to. Think about what has changed in the last 18 years in Afghanistan. Half the population now can work and be educated. the Hazaras, who are 15% of the population, who the Taliban treated terribly, and historically have been a discriminated against minority. You've got a whole generation of Afghan millennials, you know, 70% of the population is under the age of 30. They have no nostalgia for the Taliban. So overwhelmingly, there's a lot of people who can lose. And they, you know, they think that, rightly, that we're basically conducting this peace agreement over their heads. I mean, we have not included the Afghan government. I mean, you had the extraordinary thing of Hamdullah Mohib, the national security advisor, publicly taking to task Zal Khalilzad at the Hudson Institute, so much so that he was apparently called in for a dressing down by some reports of the State Department. So the point is that people are very freaking out. And I've been visiting Afghanistan since 93, so I've had a fairly good sense of what it's been like over time. And, you know, Afghanistan today is very depressing. I was there for a relatively brief time in February. February in Kabul is the time to be there, by the way. It looks like Baghdad. I mean, the 20-foot walls, the green zone has expanded. You know, I stay with a friend who's got an armored car, and people who really, you know, you can't go there as a, 10 years ago, you could go to a hotel, check in, it was kind of a pleasant place to be. That is all gone, and then you add to that this deep uncertainty, and Bruce has mentioned this. I mean, we have said some very, very confusing things about what our policy. Does anybody know what our policy really is? I mean, on August the 21st, 2017, President Trump, I think, gave a very good speech about we're going to be there. It's not time-based, it's conditions-based, and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly you have these leaks about we're going to halve the number of troops there from 14,000 to 7,000. Not really clear if that's our policy. Then you have a story by Eric Schmidt, which I'm sure is true, about the Pentagon plan for a 5-year drawdown. Then you have another story about the discussion with the Taliban, which is they want us out in several months, and we're offering 2 years. So what is our actual policy? And is the, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm, and is Zal Khalilzad sort of freelancing, Secretary Pompeo is obviously his boss. To what extent, there's no evidence that Khalilzad's met with President Trump. Is Trump sort of aware of what's going on? I don't know. But anyway, Afghans are freaking out because they're asking these questions, and for them, it's existential.
Yeah. Bruce, going to Afghanistan, I just wanted to let everybody know we will have a Q&A period. We've got microphones, so in a little bit, we will turn this over to you for questions. You and I, years ago, were on the Afghan-Pakistan border. One of the things that I noticed on that trip was how much better my cell phone reception was in along the Afghan-Pakistan border than it was in my Alexandria house. So we actually wrote a piece called "Cell Phones in the Hindu Kush" that was based something along those lines. But let's just look forward for a moment. If the U.S. forces were to withdraw, it wouldn't necessarily have to be entirely. But if they were to even take the 14,000, 15,000 size footprint and go down to pretty significant levels, low levels, or even withdraw, what's your sense about how the Taliban would operate, and what would that do to the broader terrorism picture in the country?
Well, I mean, the last I saw, Ayman al-Zawahiri and Hamza bin Laden have not withdrawn their oaths of fealty to the Taliban's leader. And also, at least a lot of the comments I see from Taliban spokesmen, including right after they've met with Zal and with others, is that it sounds like just like it's, you know, back to the future, 1996 to 2001 type of dialogue. And it's not just al-Qaeda, too. I mean, there are Uzbeks and there are various other Salafi jihadi groups there, too. In my view, historically, terrorists are always the most dangerous and the most threatening when they have access to sanctuary and safe haven, even when it's halfway around the world. And I can't imagine that al-Qaeda for that matter, Haqqani Network, various others, would not use Afghanistan as a base. I mean, the question is how much of a residual presence is enough. But I mean, this has been one of the frustrations, is the competence of the Afghan security forces, especially now at a time when the Taliban and al-Qaeda roughly control about a third of the country. It doesn't seem like a time to be really throttling back, but to be focusing on how we can reverse those gains and stabilize the country more.
I just want to clarify something, because this is something that there's a difference between control and contest, right? So, I mean, if you look at, there's two different ways to look at it. One is population, one is territory. Population is arguably more important. the Taliban only control 10% of the population, which I'm not saying, I mean, 10% is 3 million people. It's a lot of people. So we have to be careful when we say that they control a third of the country, because in fact, they contest a good amount of the country with the government, and the government controls 55% of the population. So we just,
and this is the SIGAR data you're referring to in particular?
SIGAR data in general, but the main thing is they're obviously doing pretty well, historically, compared to what they've done. And I agree the Afghan security forces, Ghani has said that 45,000 of them have been killed, which means that that is a very large number. So they're definitely fighting and dying. They have an effective Afghan special forces. But if we go down to zero, which I don't think we will, I don't think we're going to go down to zero, because it's crazy. I mean, if you're a Democratic president, Republican president, it doesn't matter who you are. Imagine the political cost. It would be Benghazi to the power of 50 million if there was an attack from the Afghan-Pakistan border and you were the person who had ordered the withdrawal of all American troops. It doesn't make no sense. And I'm not a military guy, but there's a certain number where we can do a lot of the things. The 14,000 number is not some magic number. We can probably do many of these things with 7,000. Because at the end of the day, you want NSF, kind of counterterrorism, type people to do the drones. You don't need like a large number of people eating McDonald's at a base in Kandahar. You know, that's not necessary for this.
I've done that, by the way.
Okay, we all have. To go to the Tim Hortons and...
Peter, first to you and then to Bruce. One of the individuals that Al-Qaeda has been spending some time elevating publicly, I mean, they've been doing it for some time, is Hamza. You interviewed his father, Osama. Yeah. What's your sense of what Al-Qaeda is doing in terms of leadership right now, and what's your sense of how charismatic or influential Hamza is or may be down the road?
Well, let's start with the fact that Ayman al-Zawahiri is sort of a black hole of charisma and is basically a terrible leader. And like, if you, from an American national security perspective, let's just leave him in place. He's a terrible leader. He's caused this big split in the movement. He helped this big split in the movement, which created ISIS. He's not an effect. No one's like rallying to the Zawahiri flag. If you look at ISIS propaganda, it's about bin Laden. Even though they're separated from Al-Qaeda, bin Laden and the family name is a part of the world where family name's important. Hamza has a real future, and he's half the age of Ayman al-Zawahiri, and I don't know if he's particularly charismatic or that kind of thing, but he is 30 as opposed to 68, and they're looking for market share and a younger face, and I think he's going to, if not be the leader, Saif al-Adil could become the leader, and he could be number two, but he's as you said, he's already, they've been putting him forward for years now.
Bruce, you've written a lot in the last year or so on Al-Qaeda's resurrection. Your thoughts on as ISIS's territorial control has declined, what's your sense of what Al-Qaeda is thinking about preparing for and how significant of a threat Al-Qaeda is?
Well,
because I sense you may differ slightly with Peter here.
Right, well, yeah, it's always reassuring when Peter and I at least diverge on something, because I actually think Zawahiri's been a great leader. I think strategically, I agree with you that he has a profound charisma deficit. But I think at least in charting a course for Al-Qaeda, he's been much more effective than bin Laden has. I think he's been very effective in knitting together all the Al-Qaeda franchises, in enabling them to communicate with one another and also generally fall into line behind his strategy. I thought it was fascinating that Al-Shabaab and the JNIM, for instance, came together after their respective attacks. And that was, I think, not something that was organic. I think that was part of his strategy. And it's not just me. I mean, if you look at the DNI statement before the Senate Armed Services Committee in January, he talked about Al-Qaeda with an increasingly stronger command structure with these relationships. The UN report that was released also in January spoke about an Al-Qaeda that certainly can't be ruled out. I mean, I've argued, I hope I'm wrong, but at least all the signs I see is that Zawahiri has been very gleefully sitting back, watching as ISIS has absorbed all our attention, preoccupied all our efforts, consumed our resources, while Al-Qaeda has been quietly rebuilding. It's certainly not at a stage now where it's as internationally aggressive as it might have been in the past. But, I'll borrow a line from John le Carré's Spy Who Came In From the Cold, when he said, agents aren't like airplanes. They don't adhere to schedules. I think it's the same thing with terrorist organizations. And in this case, Zawahiri has taken advantage of this huge opportunity that ISIS has created for them to enable Al-Qaeda to rebuild in one fashion or another. I'd be perhaps more optimistic, except whether it's, and this is what worries me amongst many worries, is the recent focus both by Al-Qaeda and ISIS on commercial aviation, which means that they may both certainly are shadows of what they were in the past, but they see a successful attack on commercial aviation, especially if it's Western airlines.
You think about like the Australia plot or something
Australian
like that?
Australian plot or the plot against Dalo Airlines in Mogadishu. I mean, I would put Al-Shabaab at like the C team of technologically adept terrorists, but nonetheless, what that incident of, 3 years ago now, underscored to me is that the expertise that someone like Ibrahim al-Assiri had perfected for AQAP, at a time when we were saying AQAP was the biggest threat, largely because of its commercial aviation targeting capabilities, has migrated even to comparatively technological incompetence. Mm. And in their hubris, I think in their own mythology, they believe that one successful attack like that will bring down the Western economy. I mean, that's part of their, I mean, that's the positive thing about many terrorist groups in terms of our countermeasures, is they're completely obsessed with their own success, and they therefore believe their own propaganda, and it often unravels, as it has so often in the past, with their bravado. But also they believe their own myths, and one of them is the power of attacking commercial aviation and the impact it has on us.
So one thing, Peter, if I can ask you about whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS, Europe has faced attacks. The British had Manchester and a number. The U.S. has been, the plots and attacks recently have been pretty limited right now. What's your sense about the threat to the homeland, the U.S. homeland today?
Well, we haven't been attacked by a foreign terrorist organization successfully since 9/11. So, yeah. The facts speak for themselves. The last time a foreign terrorist organization put together a serious plot was May 1st, 2010, Faisal Shahzad in Times Square. He was trained by the Pakistani Taliban. Al-Qaeda was 2009 with Najib al-Azazi and also the Underwear plot. So, I mean, that's now a decade in the rearview mirror. So the plot, the issue is Americans radicalizing online. That's got nothing to do with travel ban countries. It's got, obviously the travel ban doesn't stop the internet. And, people are, look at Omar Mateen. I mean, he was born in Queens, New York. He's a totally American guy, killed 49 people in Orlando, radicalized online. He was kind of shopping. He was at one point talking about Hezbollah and then Al-Qaeda and then he declared himself for ISIS. I mean, it's that kind of person. And in fact, if you look at the New Zealand attacker, Brenton Tarrant, he and Omar Mateen had a lot in common, I thought. They were both roughly both the same age, 28, 29. They were sort of radicalizing online. They didn't really meet anybody of any, Omar Mateen met nobody in the jihadi circle. They saw themselves as kind of carrying out this heroic thing. One in, for Mateen, it was being pledging allegiance to Baghdadi and being a soldier of the caliphate. For Tarrant, it was getting kind of some kind of blessing, he says, in his from the Knights Templar, which is a fictitious organization that did exist in the Middle Ages, but it sort of comes out of Anders Breivik's fevered imagination. So they were very similar. But and I say so the vector is, the radicalization is online, whether it's these right wing extremists or jihadists, and they're threatening. In this country, they're very threatening because they can acquire semi-automatic weapons completely legally, even if they've been subject of. Omar Mateen, the FBI talked to him twice. But he was able to buy semi-automatic weapons. And it's always seemed to me that if you're on the no-fly list, you shouldn't be able to buy semi-automatic weapons. But even that common sense measure has not passed in this political environment.
Well, before coming back to New Zealand and far-right attacks, I wanted to ask Bruce, one of the issues we've been discussing is at least talking around a little bit is external operations. As you look at Al-Qaeda or even the Islamic State, where are you most concerned about overseas that the U.S. needs to be concerned about external operations? There's a lot of focus, for example, on ISIS in Syria, but Al-Qaeda's got a presence in the Idlib area, for example, and potentially concerns about external plotting from that area. So what's your sense about the areas we've got to be concerned about from a terrorist plotting perspective?
Well, I think both, more so I'd say in ISIS's case in external operations, the threat is probably greatest in Europe, not in the United States. I mean, apart from the various conflictual areas where there are franchises. Certainly ISIS, as we know, had built up an external operations capability in Europe 2 years before the French November 2015 attacks. I'm sure it's eroded over time, but at least this past weekend, the Sunday Times had an article about quote-unquote crocodile cells, about an attempt by ISIS to revive its external operations, which I suspect certainly the attempts are going to be there and will materialize. I think Al-Qaeda, because of this strategy now of sitting back and watching as ISIS preoccupies our attention and absorbs all the blows, is far more reluctant to engage in that type of thing. But I don't think it's a capability that they have necessarily abandoned. I mean, you think about it, when Haider Kirkhan was killed in 2016, a senior Al-Qaeda figure in Syria, I mean, one of the things the Pentagon said is why he was so important, that it was the need to take him out, is because he was allegedly planning and plotting attacks against the West and potentially against the United States. Similarly, that same year when Farouk Al-Qahtani was killed in eastern Afghanistan, the same thing was asserted. So, I mean, aspiring to do so and being able to do so, as we know, are two separate things. But as long as they're still thinking about it, means we can't completely relax. And then, I mean, just as Peter, I think, very cogently described, I mean, we talk about the United States, there's a completely different level of threat that comes from homegrown lone wolves that are not Salafi jihadists, for example.
Well, what's your sense, Peter? You've written a book on this recently. What's your sense about the state of inspired extremism in the U.S. right now?
Well, you know, there's a imperfect way to answer that, which is in 2015, the FBI indicted, Department of Justice indicted 80 people, and in 2018, they indicted five for the jihadi, on the jihadi terrorism. So, you know, indictments aren't a perfect measure, but when they're, you know, falling off a cliff, it means that, you know, no one, the ISIS lost, and it was losing for a long time. And it began, you know, in Syria, you know, the operation to retake Mosul began in October 2016. So this is, they've been losing for a while. And so it was just less exciting to join them. So, you know, there will be a son of ISIS and grandson of ISIS that may not be quite as exciting. But there aren't that many takers. I mean, the problem is, you know, it's a big country with a lot of people. So, you know, you know, I think the only other country in the world which has more per capita weapons is Yemen, or we may beat Yemen. I'm not sure, one of the two. But the point is that if you have these ideas and you want to do something about it, whether it's jihadi or right wing or whatever, I mean, this is a great place to do it. So, you know, we're not, political violence has been around. I mean, Bruce has been studying this for quite a period of time. But one thing to remember is, you know, the 70s was the time of great political violence for coming out of the left, and also Puerto Rican nationalists, and there were 100 hijackings in the 1970s, which is, you know, unheard of now. And so one thing that I'm interested in is an uptick in black nationalist violence. There have been, New America, where I work, we track all forms of political violence since 9/11. We've seen 8 people being killed by people motivated by black nationalists. Now, they're not part of a group. They're just motivated by the ideology. They're radicalizing online. None of these people are part of a group, in a sense, whether on the jihadi side, or the right-wing side, or black nationalists. But they are motivated by these violent ideologies.
So, Bruce, this is a good segue. One of the issues that was interesting in last year's British counterterrorism strategy contest was they did elevate the importance of the far right and the threat to the UK. Obviously, we've had New Zealand, we've had threats in other places. What's your sense right now about where the far right threat is going? How serious is it, and how much should we be concerned about it?
Well.
And actually, you've defined this in many places, so it may be helpful for you to describe what you mean by far right here, so people realize it's not a Republican-Democratic issue.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, actually, that's easy enough to say. Unfortunately, though, it is a grab bag. White supremacists, racists, anti-federalists, militant opponents of legalized abortion, the fringes of the sovereign citizens movement, which is not a white supremacist movement, but nonetheless is very anti-federalist, anti-Semites as well. I mean, people are, very extreme views in that, often ascribe to ideology such as National Socialism, mm-hmm. for example. Well, I mean, I've spent the past 18 years obviously studying Salafi jihadi terrorism, but I had a previous 20 years or plus that I was in terrorism and had done a lot of work on the far right. And I think what we sometimes forget is, I think two of the most consequential trends that we see in terrorism today that actually ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but ISIS even more so, have hijacked as their own, actually originated with the extreme far right in the United States in the 1980s, and that was the use of computers for communication, for radicalization purposes, as rallying cries, and also the entire lone wolf phenomenon. Both actually could vector back to one person, Louis Beam, who was a former Vietnam veteran, a grand dragon of the Texas Ku Klux Klan, who came up with these strategies in response to the effectiveness that the FBI was having in dismantling the white supremacist movement as it existed in previous decades. And that, in my view, is what makes the extreme right so dangerous now, is that they have historically been the most innovative, and other terrorists have borrowed from them. So the fact that they see now, and especially in the mass shooting phenomena, which, you know, as Peter just described, given the number of armaments in this country, we don't have a great solution for, at least not one that will be as speedily embraced as New Zealand's, that their ability to identify trends and then harness them and then promulgate them and encourage them is something that I think is alarming. Because again, it's that conceit of an individual person who believes fundamentally that they can change the course of history is what's always animated terrorism and fits very much in with whether it's the New Zealand attack or the attack. It's the same, you know, conspiratorial worldview that you saw in the Tree of Life Synagogue shootings back in October in Pittsburgh.
Peter, on this issue, what surprised you or confirmed views about the New Zealand attack? I mean, what were your key takeaways from what we saw in New Zealand?
Well, just picking up on what Bruce said, I mean, Louis Beam is very interesting. He wrote a treatise called Leaderless Resistance, which, you know, basically, you know, is the model that these groups are following. And the theory being law enforcement has a very hard time, you know, and Abu Musab al-Suri then wrote a book which had a similar kind of theme in 2005 on the internet. In terms of the attack, you know, and one thing is houses of worship, and Bruce can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think houses of worship were routinely attacked in the pre-9/11 era. It seems there's been a change. If you look at whether it's a synagogue in Pittsburgh or a mosque in New Zealand or a mosque in Finsbury Park, where there's been or a bomb that was placed in a mosque in Minnesota, we've seen more attacks on houses of worship, and this seems like a slightly new phenomenon. That's my impression. The second is that, of course, there's been a whole string of attacks on Muslim places of worship, and none of this was, you know, totally surprising, except, you know, happening in New Zealand. That is surprising. The fact that he was able to kill so many people, relatively speaking, shows the damage one person can do, unfortunately.
So how much along these lines? How important is it, the ability of these extremist networks, whether they're far right, far left, religious extremists, to communicate online or through social media? How much has that changed the dynamics of terrorism?
Well, let me just add something to Peter. I think before 9/11, I mean, there were certainly synagogue attacks, Abu Nidal organization, a Turkish synagogue in 1986, the Rue Copernic in Paris, attacked by far-right terrorists in the early 1980s, Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires in 94. Mm-hmm. Sporadic, but you could see, at least in synagogues, that it was often, and this led to enhanced security measures at many synagogues, not necessarily in the United States, but throughout the world, that have only been increased in recent decades. I think, but going back to the Christchurch tragedy, I mean, what struck me is just how totally enmeshed in social media this guy was. I mean, he bought a minicam to strap onto his forehead to live stream the attacks. He presaged them, you know, on Twitter and Facebook. He posted his treatise, you know, 70 plus pages for anybody to see. So, I mean, Brian Jenkins very famously said, you know, 40 years ago that terrorism is theater, and we see with the power of social media, I mean, gosh, that's become even more profound now. And actually, you can completely cut out the traditional media, so doesn't matter if these things aren't reported, at least he's getting them out there ahead of time, and then you've got to take remedial steps to shut them down afterwards, which becomes a lot more challenging.
Yeah, Tarrant was his own producer and his own live broadcaster, and the first time we saw that was in Paris in 2016 when a ISIS-inspired militant killed a police officer and his female companion, yeah. Did it in front of their three-year-old That's kid right. and broadcast on Facebook Live. So in the future, we're going to, you've got to assume that every attack is going to be yeah. live streamed on Facebook, which causes, the fact that there were 1.5 million copies of this thing on Facebook, it seems that, you know, and I guess 8chan was sort of implicated in making sure it didn't go off the internet. But I mean, that's a impossible task. To police that. I mean, the volume is just is off the charts, not to say that Facebook shouldn't be trying harder and blah, 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 but in any future attack, you've got to assume that there's going to be a live element to the actual event that is outside the traditional media and will get out there.
Last question to both of you, and then we'll open it up. If you read through the National Defense Strategy and you gauge the direction that the U.S. is going in, including the Department of Defense's optimization strategy, so pulling out of the Sahel, for example, what is your sense about the risks or the benefits of a shift away from counterterrorism towards state-based competition? Is it too early? Is it a long time coming? Should we have done this before? How do you see the strategic decisions that the U.S. is making on this issue?
Well, none of these threats at any level, whether they're from states or from non-state actors, are linear, so we shouldn't assume they are. And we've got to constantly recalibrate and adjust our national security and defenses to the threats that are out there. I think what worries me the most is that, at least over the past 18 years, as I said earlier, we swing from opposite extremes, from invading countries to having absolutely no presence there, when we know even those countries that claim they can counter terrorism on their own still repeat it. Even Turkey, after Erdogan told President Trump back in December, we could handle everything against ISIS, but the next weekend he turned to the United States for airlift capacity and for intelligence assets. So it's constantly finding that balance. But I think the most important aspect that at least the past 18 years should have taught us is that just like great power competition has resurfaced and never really went away, I mean, terrorism is a fixture of 21st century national security. And it may not be as resource intensive as it was a decade ago, but that doesn't mean that it's faded as a threat.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a political problem, which is we have managed and contained this problem, but it's politically hard to say that because, you know, if there's an attack of any kind, you sort of, and at the same time, you know, by the law of averages, even though we've managed to contain it, it's going to continue, you know, they're going to get one through. But I mean, there's a lot of commonalities between Trump and Obama on this issue. We're not sending, you know, massive land armies into the Middle East. We're sending relatively small groups of special forces, advisors and trainers. We're deploying drones, we're using cyber warfare where appropriate, and that's it. And whoever is the president, whether it's a Trump second term or some other Democratic, he or she will follow the same template. And there's a great deal of kind of commonality between the two parties, and sometimes it's the same people. I mean, Mike Leiter was held over by Obama, and he was a head of NCTC under George W. Bush. Nick Rasmussen was held over by Trump, and he was the head of NCTC under Obama. Josh Geltzer, who was senior director of counterterrorism, similarly was held over by Trump. So there's a consensus, and I think the consensus based around it, this actually works. Isn't, you know, we're not sending massive numbers of American body bags from these zones, and we're kind of managing and containing the problem.
There's a lot that we did not cover, even in the first part of this. So we'll let you ask questions. We've got microphones. If you could raise your hand, and we'll then go. We've got one right here. Just for everybody too. Just keep it to a question.
Thanks.
I have two questions, but I'll be real short. No preambles. One is on the far right. Whether the things that been reading in the paper about the Azov militia and its connections with the United States. Is that something to be concerned
The Azov
about?
Meaning the one in Ukraine?
Yes. And the second one is money. We haven't talked about money. If you're starting an organization, you may need money. ISIS beat out al-Qaeda, I think, in some cases, like Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, because it had money, and so they went to where the money is. Do they still have money? Are they still making money, or is that game over?
I'm going to let you answer the Ukraine. I have no idea.
Oh, the Ukraine one, I have no idea. the money one, finances, terrorism finances is the easier one.
Nice, you guys are both trying to get the other one to answer the hard question.
Indeed.
How about money?
Well, money, look, I mean, there's various different things you can say. One is terrorist organizations are made up of volunteers, and you can't pay people to commit suicide. It's one thing you really can't pay them for. And so if you look at a group like al-Qaeda, you know, money was not that important. It was a case of mirror imaging to say that, you know, that was really important to them. If you're running an insurgent army where you have to put people on the payroll, like the ISIS, which had a 30,000-man army, or the Taliban, which has a 30,000-man army, that requires a lot of money. So, you know, in ISIS case, most of their money didn't come from kidnapping or, you know, kind of antiquity smuggling or oil. Most of their money came from the fact they control population. They control 8 million people, and they could tax and extort them, and that's a lot of money. And the Taliban has, you know, basically control of the largest heroin production kind of, you know, facility in the world. And so that's, so I think if you're running an insurgency, you need money. If you're running a terrorist group, it's mostly made up of volunteers. The money is relatively trivial.
I would say that ISIS amassed considerable funds, individual taxation, trafficking, and antiquities, which still goes on, that they probably have a sufficient, especially just as you point out, when you actually control territory, you need money. Without the territory, it's less critical, but I think they have ample amounts of money. Just this weekend, Eric Schmidt, the other reporters in the New York Times, estimated that it was somewhere between 50 and 300 million. Mm. I mean, whatever it is, when you think that terrorist operations at most cost $10,000 or something like that, I mean, that's enough to fund a lot of activity.
And of course, ISIS seized the central bank in Mosul, and one of my favorite New York Post headlines was the United States bombed the bank at a certain point, and it was U.S. makes big deposit. there was. Money was very important for them, clearly, and they must retain some, as you say.
Yeah. And I can't answer the Ukraine one, sorry.
Here.
Hi, my name is Neil. I'm with the American Legion, and my question is, so it seems like that the sense of it is that while our focus was a turn to ISIS, al-Qaeda was able to build back up. What's to say this won't be a back and forth between them or other fringe groups? How is this gonna, is there an end to this between, while we focus our attention on one fringe group or one extremist group that pops up, the others don't build back up and just re-attack the same way? So, because we're seeing that with al-Qaeda right now.
I'm gonna have Bruce answer that first, in part to add to your question too. You've also looked at the possibility of mergers in the past as well.
Well, I mean, the ideological differences between al-Qaeda and ISIS, I think, are completely negligible, and ISIS still reveres bin Laden. I mean, they see themselves as the true exemplars or the true implementers of his vision. I mean, I've always argued that the biggest impediment, at least in the past, I think a lot has changed, not least in Syria, but in the past, was the very profound personal enmity between al-Baghdadi and al-Zawahiri. And if one or the other was eliminated, I think then, you know, it's an open question whether there wouldn't be some facilitation of some cooperation or not. I think, though, when I look at this right now, and it's something I focused on, I think al-Qaeda would probably covet ISIS's external operations capability, such as it is now, which I think is being eroded somewhat, but hasn't been completely eviscerated or eliminated. But what I think has really contributed to al-Qaeda's longevity is that in the aftermath of bin Laden's killings, I mean, al-Zawahiri made two key decisions within a month of becoming emir. One was to disperse the al-Qaeda leadership across a variety of countries. So you have al-Qaeda leaders in Iran now, Turkey, Syria, obviously, Yemen, Afghanistan, probably Pakistan. So they're impervious to any kind of decapitation, or much more so than in the past. So that resiliency in this. His second move, of course, was to send Mohammad Jalani to Iraq and Syria to build what was Jabhat al-Nusra, and has now come through certain other iterations. So in that sense, I think al-Qaeda now is styling themselves, I think deliberately in contrast to ISIS, as quote-unquote moderate extremists, and as a more palatable alternative, which may actually, you know, somewhat militate against any kind of merger, so al-Qaeda can continue to sort of mine that kind of trope.
Bruce, if I could just ask you one follow-up, before going to Peter, what is your sense about how they operate differently? Al-Qaeda does appear to be much more willing to embed itself in local organizations. Right. So ISIS probably less so, but your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a product of ISIS's success in Syria and Iraq, where Al-Qaeda, which never really was interested in local governance in the past, they always subcontracted it out to their partners or to their franchises. In the aftermath, I think, of ISIS's success, one of al-Zawahiri's, let's say his third key strategic move was to really build this sort of global phenomenon where Al-Qaeda paid much more deference and devolved a lot more autonomy to local franchises to harness the local grievances and to actually attempt to address them, which were things that Bin Laden really was very aloof to, so long as they conformed to the overall Al-Qaeda framework. And I think, again, technology, especially communications technology, and probably Edward Snowden to some extent, has facilitated a lot of this, that using end-to-end encryption, Al-Qaeda is probably better networked and better connected with its franchises. It's not issuing orders or interfering on a day-to-day basis, but there's much more of a flow that emphasizes these local grievances and local issues that has given Al-Qaeda, I think, just a greater traction in places than they had in the past.
ISIS, Al-Qaeda?
Didn't you write a paper about Al-Qaeda in Syria?
I did, but I'm asking you.
No. But your paper. I mean, I took away that Al Qaeda in Syria wasn't doing quite as well as we thought.
I mean, I would just say on that, I think the issue was the HTS, the relationship at the time we wrote it, the relationship between Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and Zawahiri was problematic. I think what Al-Qaeda's done with HAD in Syria is establish other networks in the Idlib area as well. So I think it's this does show how fluid the broader jihadist movement is.
I mean, the biggest change that I've seen since reporting on this is sectarianism. If Bin Laden was here and we asked him, why are you at war with the United States, he would have said support of Israel, support of Egypt, support of the Saudis. He, you know, his mother was an Alawite, is an Alawite, she's still alive. He didn't go down that path, and Al-Qaeda didn't really go down that path and tried to restrain Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. So the reason I mention all that is that sectarianism, destroyed Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, and is beginning, is showing up in Afghanistan. Every month there's a major attack on the Hazara, killing a lot of people, and ISIS is carrying out these attacks, I'm sure. The point is, and they've got you've got very deep pockets on both sides of the sectarian aisle, who there could be a war if one of these Houthi Iranian supplied missiles fired by the Houthis, and they fired 211 of them so far, lands in downtown Riyadh and kills a lot of people. The Saudis are going to have to respond. Now they may not go to war with Iran directly, in fact, they probably won't, but they will certainly, there will be tremendous. One thing that MBS has done is he's substituted Saudi nationalism for Wahhabism, and that's basically the sort of the play that is happening. And so the nationalistic Saudis are going to say, we need to respond. And so, separating out like Shia-Sunni rivalry and also Iran-Saudi rivalry for the region, they're not exactly the same things, but they are related. And that is a big thing that is, but neither side is planning to dial this back. I mean, MBS has publicly said that the Khomeini is like Hitler, in an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg of the Atlantic. So I mean, there is a pretty intense hatred on both sides of this. And for the Saudis, they see the Houthi fight as basically existential. Imagine if a Chinese-supported militia took much of Mexico and Mexico City, we would have very strong views about this, and that's how they see it. And so I think that, this is the thing that's going to drive this conflict forward, because ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whatever this group is called, I mean, their main claim is we're going to protect you from the terrible Shia, right? That's the, when we've seen that with Al-Qaeda in Iraq and ISIS and others. And so that I think is going to be the driver, the main driver.
Chinese in Mexico or Russians in Venezuela now. So we have a question here.
Cubans as well.
Hi, Amanda Shaw. A lot of the discussion has been about the appropriate level of military engagement. My question is, as Congress poises itself for the appropriations process, specifically a debate on the appropriate level of foreign aid, Are there any particular models that you have seen work in Afghanistan or Iraq in curtailing these extremist groups that the government should consider continuing to fund?
Good question.
Yeah, I think we've discussed it. I mean, it's special forces support. I mean, look at our support of the counterterrorism service in Iraq. I mean, the Iraqi military imploded in 2014. Now the counterterrorism service is quite an effective, very effective kind of ground force, and with American support. And so supporting them, that's proven to be a very effective approach. And so I would continue in the budget, you know, giving, I think the counterterrorism service receives about $300 million from the United States. And that's money well spent.
You were also trying to gauge the non-military assistance as well?
Okay. Well, development, you know, that it's all, yeah. Well, that's a very large question, which I'm going to pass on.
To Bruce.
Well, I don't think there's any successful strategy against terrorism or insurgency that's exclusively kinetic or that relies on the military. And I think finding the right model somewhere and finding, you know, how much is enough has always remained elusive. I mean, one of the main difficulties, I think, with Congress is that the metrics for countering ideology or countering radicalization are often a lot softer and certainly pushed out in time in any meaningful way, so that the instant results you have when you target a drone, for instance, on a terrorist leader or terrorist followers, and you could actually quantify what you've achieved is very instantaneously too, is much more appealing. But I think that's actually been one of the Achilles heels over the past 18 years, and something that we have to understand better if we're going to break this constant cycle of rejuvenation and regeneration that seems to occur in our terrorist adversaries. I mean, when you think about it, the last time a counterterrorism strategy was released by the United States in 2011, I mean, the main threat was Al-Qaeda. And you look at the most recent counterterrorism strategy, not only was this tremendous focus on ISIS, but there was also a focus on Iran and on the threat from Shia-backed terrorism. But also, commendably, back in October, they were talking about also the rising threat from the far right, which is multiplied. So there's not a kinetic or a bullet solution for all these types of problems. But it's very easy to become frustrated and saying, well, what's the best course to take in countering ideology? I don't think we've actually really seriously had that sort of, at least as that discussion in terms of budgetary allocation and the particular constraints and limitations and expectations you have to have.
Question? Yeah, right here.
Thank you very much, Rahim Rashidi or Mr. Kurt from Kurdistan TV. In your opinion, what will be the USA policies on the Kurds after ISIS, and how would you describe the Kirkuk situation? Because ISIS became active day after day around the Kirkuk. Thank you.
Well, Peter's been there more recently, so he could probably answer more authoritatively, but at least from my observations, of course, is that the Kurds have been absolutely pivotal in the struggle against ISIS. I think your point about this rising tide of ISIS subversion in Kirkuk and in other areas that have recently been liberated is exactly what ISIS's post-caliphate strategy is. I mean, this is, you know, goes back to Saddam Hussein or then before, is laying down the capability, a stay behind or a fifth columnist type of capacity to engage in terrorism, and also to argue to the Sunni populations there that they're the only guarantor, the only effective protection, which ensures that the violence that has recently receded from those areas at one level or another will be resumed.
Questions?
Just trying to lay you back here.
Elizabeth Dvorak, I'm with a State Department funded project that works on countering human trafficking in Afghanistan, and I spent 7 years in country between 2003 and now. My question is, let me just preface the question, because when I was working in Afghanistan, I worked on counterinsurgency, I worked on counter-narcotics with the US forces, and now I'm on the human rights side. But what we weren't allowed, we didn't have mandate when we were doing counter-narcotics, is to do the mapping. The counter-narcotics groups, the supply chain mapping, are well in bed with the insurgent groups. Whereas with insurgency, we had the mandate to look strictly at the under, you know, we could look research-wise at the relationships to narcotics, but there weren't comprehensive discussions with all the bodies involved. Now, looking, my project falls strictly under human rights, and yet for every one of those 2.3 million refugees that ended up in Europe, we don't know how many are crossed in, you know, the Afghan government has been very poor in border control. We don't know how many are in insurgent groups. We don't know how many are in Turkish prisons. We don't know how many actually are being trafficked. And the relationships to me seem so siloed. As someone that spent so long in theater and sees that, you know, I do see the relationship and have studied the relationship, and I'm wondering if, you know, we could, if any of your research deals with this or if that's been an issue. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very interesting observation. Yeah, on the counter narcotics, I mean, we have had a, I don't think, a particularly effective strategy in Afghanistan, to be honest. I mean, the proof is that, you know, Afghanistan is still one of the world's leading producer of heroin and funds the insurgency. And, you know, we, when we have tended to have counter-narcotics campaigns, usually the people whose fields get burned are the people who can't afford the to pay the bribe, rather than sort of the big drug dealers. But anyway, this is a problem that's bedeviled the United States for a long time, and we don't seem to have had a particularly good solution.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics about Afghanistan, but certainly throughout history, I mean, this is one of the problems in countering terrorism, is that it's not this very siloed problem. In fact, that terrorist group revenue, its extension of coercion over populations are all things that are done in a very patronage network, whether it's the cultivation of narcotics or indeed moving people. And terrorist groups have historically profited from human trafficking. So I think it underscores the compound nature of the problem, and that pulling at one thread of it, for instance, decapitating the leadership. I mean, why these types of strategies in the past have been ineffective, and why you need a much more comprehensive approach in countering terrorism that gets to the finances, but also their relationship with populations and their abuse of populations in particular.
We have time for one last question right here, and then we'll wrap it up.
Rebecca Malone, I was wondering, even though ISIS core has been decimated, affiliates are still active. I'm thinking particularly like West Africa, Sinai, Southeast Asia, and a little lesser so in Libya. So what is the current role of ISIS affiliates, and what role will they play in the future?
Well, this is a great last question from one of my students at Georgetown University Security Studies
program. I didn't plant this, by the way.
No, but so particularly pleased. I mean, that to me has been one of the interesting phenomena about ISIS as well, which again suggests to me that they're not going to go away very quickly, is that they had a plan for survival. I mean, that's I think, the best terrorist organizations, firstly, best terrorist groups, rather, are learning organizations, but also have to think strategically because their survival is caught up with that. So you already have back in, certainly in September 2016, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi saying to foreign fighters, you know, don't come to the caliphate to fight, but instead you should migrate to one of the ISIS branches throughout the world. And I think this has caught us by surprise, is that even though we've defeated the physical manifestations of the caliphate in Syria and Iraq, I mean, I just thought that portion of the national counterterrorism strategy was missed by most of the commentators. Yet we've taken down the caliphate in this, you know, set roughly 79 or 69 country coalition, but yet, under our noses, ISIS built at least 8 official networks and eight official branches and 24 networks. And just like Al-Qaeda reverted to that same strategy over a decade ago, where it understood it had to devolve some of its top-down authority to local affiliates. I mean, ISIS just followed the same pattern and has been able to establish a presence. And if you look at that heat map, for instance, that the National Counterterrorism Center recently produced, I mean, it's fascinating to watch. I mean, Nigeria is growing, you know, pretty hot red. Libya is more in the pink side. Afghanistan is more red. Philippines, for example, that, to my knowledge, at least 3 or 4 years ago, there was no ISIS presence in the Philippines, and there is now. One of the tremendous successes in counterterrorism is what the Indonesians had done in dismantling Jamaah Islamiyah. But yet, when you look at that heat map, that's also glowing in Indonesia. So ISIS has been able, even while we've been taking down the caliphate and very effectively fighting them and killing upwards of 70,000 fighters in the Levant and in Iraq, they've been putting in place, I think, exactly the foundation, or the toeholds, let's say, that they're going to hope to translate into footholds that will ensure their longevity. And for me, the evidence of this is, you know, the Ariana Grande attack in Manchester, England in 2017 was perpetrated by a cell in Benghazi where ISIS had been significantly weakened that had connections with other cells in Spain and Brussels and in Denmark as well, for example.
Peter, you get the last word. You can either us the glass half full or the glass half empty.
I have nothing to add. That was a brilliant explanation.
That's a glass half full, I think. Well, if you can all thank me, or thank Peter and Bruce, thank me too. Thank Peter and Bruce for joining us. It was an honor to have you here. I hope we get you back. But thank you all for coming. You can watch this. If you missed parts of it, you can watch this online as well. We'll post the video. Thanks. Thank you.